This is a book about America. It is about sheriffs and television and God. It is about patriotism and national identity. It is about American culture, from television to religion to national politics. It is about the inspiration this country gives to many others. It is about how Americans punish. Over the past 35 years, the form of punishment in the United States has changed enormously. Our laws are harsher now. Convicts serve longer sentences than they once did for identical offenses. As a result, our prison and jail facilities are more crowded than those in other Western democracies. The numbers can startle. The United States, with 5% of the Earth's population, is home to nearly a quarter of its prisoners. Since 1973, the nation's imprisonment rate has multiplied more than 5 times, leaving the United States with both the highest such rate in the world and the largest prison system.
That's author Anne Marie Cusick reading from the introduction to her new book, Cruel and Unusual, The Culture of Punishment in America. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Air. The Eighth Amendment says that we shall not inflict cruel and unusual punishments, but America still employs torture and restraint, corporal and capital punishment, and punitive physical pain. What does our attitude towards criminals and punishment say about us? How have our practices changed over the centuries? Joining us to explore punishment in America is Anne Marie Cusack, professor of communication at Roosevelt University and author of Cruel and Unusual, The Culture of Punishment in America. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you very much.
What led you to choose this topic, the topic of punishment?
Well, I chose it inadvertently. In a way, it chose me. I was a new employee at the Progressive magazine in Madison, and I'd been there for, a couple months, and I started begging for an investigative story. And my editor said, well, why don't you take this one? It was a story about stun belts, and he had seen a little notice in Prison Legal News that the Bureau of Prisons was bringing these devices in. He wanted me to write about it. But my reaction was not very positive, I guess I would say. I wasn't a fan of it. As I started reporting on this stun belt, which the manufacturer claimed was humane but also said would devastate prisoners, it led me to find, that there were serious questions about the device and that it caused serious pain and that it was potentially going to be misused, potentially for torture. I kept reporting on this, and the more reporting I did, the more I started to wonder, why these devices coming into our prison systems, because it wasn't just stun belts, but many other, why they were coming in and what had changed and whether that affected our culture more broadly. So that's what led me to the topic and led me to the book. It's an exploration that came out of my reporting.
The statistic that you gave in that opening about how the United States has 5% of the world's population, but roughly 25% of the world's prisoners, that's an enormous figure, in terms of the amount of prisoners that we have. You also state that, ironically, it seems to be because we're a culture of freedom, because we value freedom, we somehow lock more people up. Explain that paradox.
Well, I let me add a couple of figures to this. 1 in 31 is in the justice system broadly. That includes probation and parole. 1 in 100 is in prison. And the cost of prisons, imprisonment, has gone from $11 billion in the 70s to above $50 billion now. So the cost is very high also. We positioned ourselves in many ways as a culture of punishment at the beginning, but a different kind of punishment than the British kind of punishment. So I guess it goes back to revolutionary times.
Well, let's go back even before revolutionary times to colonial times, because you do include in your book some early accounts of the kind of punishment that was done, whether it was dunking women and ducking them into water or putting people in stocks and pillories and so on. There have been so many different kinds of punishment. Take us back to the earliest times in America, where I assume we mostly just adopted what was done in Britain.
Yeah, in Britain and Europe. I mean, you had a lot of physical punishments coming over. You had certainly the dunking still, which is famous, but also all sorts of other punishments that include things, you know, the stocks, things like nailing people's ears to the pillory, punishments for all sorts of things that we probably wouldn't punish today, not attending church, baking bad bread, etc. And those were physical. And whipping was one of the more common ones. And also some capital punishment executions in the public square. They tended to be public. And that is a big difference from punishment today and punishment at that point. So these were public demonstrations. They, in some cases, they included branding of people. They included marks. If you were a heretic, you would get an H marked in your forehead, etc. And other physical marks that hurt. Like, actually, Thomas Jefferson thought adultery should include a hole in the nose. Adulterers should be marked that way. So he was actually very, even in that statement, influenced by those earlier punishments. But, you know, and when I think about what that served and really what scholars say about it, because there's a long history of scholarship on this issue, often people will talk about this retribution in public as a kind of emotional act that allowed the community to keep going. That is, the person who's punished is punished in public. Everybody sees it. It's physical. It hurts. But there's also a crowd there to monitor it. And that crowd decides when that person's done. And also, crowds were known to tame those who were doing the punishing, including actually here in Wisconsin with their first public execution. But once that punishment was finished, the perpetrator became part of the community again. There was no shutting off of people from
the
community.
So no jails and prisons, just right. Punishment and then you're done? Or yeah. Execution, and then it's over.
Then it's over, yeah. Yeah. So
you mentioned Benjamin Rush, I think, too, later on with the tranquilizing chair.
Yeah, you know, I mean, Benjamin Rush is remarkable for a couple things. And one of the things he was a revolutionary who, like many other revolutionaries, reacted against those physical punishments I'm talking about. So he wrote against public punishments. He thought that it would harden sensibilities and make people, it would harden your feelings in other ways, so that people would stop taking care of their families and they would stop taking care of children and they would stop caring about their neighbors. And he, at the same time, came up with a couple ideas that were very popular as a reaction after the revolution. These guys who were revolutionaries were guilty of treason and would have been hung. You know, they knew that. So they were very nervous about British punishment. And you actually see in some of their writings early on these senses that the British were unfair and they were going to punish them unfairly. So, you know, in the reaction he had, he really advocated for a prison. Now, prisons had been developed before the 18th century. There were prisons in Europe. But he was really part of, he and William Penn and some others, of this idea of a kind of modernization of the prison. And the idea of a prison as a long-term place. He came up with a couple ideas for prisons. One sounded very dark and punitive and cruel. And the other was really designed to change people. That was Benjamin Rush. At the same time, he came up with this idea of the tranquilizing chair. That device is a chair that holds the body completely still, or as much as it can. So it's got straps over the arms, the legs, the chest. And in Rush's version, it also enclosed the head in a box. And that device he saw as humane. You'll remember that I just said those other inventors said their devices were humane. This is a very common thing to say, it turns out.
Well, you said the stun gun, they were supposed to be humane but also devastating, which seemed
right.
A bit
paradoxical. Benjamin Rush's idea of a prison was solitary confinement, which he also thought was humane. But the tranquilizing chair ended up, he advocated for it for people who are mentally ill. He said it would calm them down. But it went into prisons. It went into the Eastern State Penitentiary in Pennsylvania. And a few decades later, there were allegations that it was being used for torture. Now, when I finally came along a long time later, there was a new device on the market called the restraint chair. It did not include a box, and it was not wood. But in many other respects, it was a lot like this tranquilizing chair.
Is it sort of like a straight jacket, only it's the whole chair that's...
The body's not enclosed in fabric or anything. It's a chair you sit in. It kind of throws people backwards a little bit, but it's a straight chair. It's plastic and metal, and there were straps that went over people's arms and legs and held their chest in place, so the head could move in this device. And I had heard about this because there were a couple cases where someone had died after being put into one of these, and where there were claims that someone had been beaten in it and mistreated physically. So I started looking at it, and the manufacturer talked to me, and in fact seemed very much to believe that this was a humane device. I believe him. I mean, he said it would hold prisoners still and enclose them the way if you close a puppy in your hands, it calms down. So it would calm people down. It didn't really have that effect in some cases. If someone was on drugs, they seemed to get more agitated. And by the time I was reporting, I found 11 deaths that had occurred after use of this. So someone was, you know, there were a number of different reasons for this. In some cases, people were beaten while in it. Of course, they can't fight back. And in some cases, people seemed to asphyxiate when they were very, very agitated after being on drugs or et cetera. And in Sacramento, there was a case involving guards who threatened inmates with electrocution after putting them in restraint chairs and putting a mask on them, spit mask, but it would cover the eyes. So there were cases of, you know, strange and inappropriate behavior, to say the least. So.
In your early chapter, kind of talking about colonial times, the Puritans and so on, you call the chapter When Punishment is the Subject, Religion is the Predicate. Uh-huh. Can you talk about the link early on in this country between religious belief and punishment?
Well, one thing I would say is that the punishments that came across from Europe came from a religious tradition. So you had back, you know, as far as medieval times, you had punishment that included death being given out by the church. Once the king took over these punishments, the king had a kind of divine presence, you know. You had Henry VIII basically controlling the church and the monarchy at the same time. So once the punishments traveled to the United States and you had a king in Europe that was administering them from overseas, those punishments had both that monarchical force but also this religious force. And to some extent, this just comes from dividing good from bad. I mean, we divide good from bad when we're just deciding who gets punished. And those meanings are often also religious meanings. You know, we inherit a religious tradition that does that. So they get aligned. I will read a little portion from 1634, a letter by a man named Thomas Hartley from Hunger Parish, Virginia, who sent a letter to John Endicott, who was former governor of Massachusetts. It contained an account of torture by ducking stool. And the device, Hartley explains, is especially useful for punishing women. And this was one device that really was associated with women. A lot of these are not. They have a law which reads somewhat in this wise: whereas it be a sin and a shame for scolding and lying tongues to be left to run loose, as is too often the way amongst women, be it therefore enacted, ye any woman, who shall, after being warned three several times by your church, persist in excessive scolding, or in backbiting her neighbors, shall be brought before ye magistrate for examination, and if ye offence be fairly proved upon her, she shall be taken by an officer appointed for your purpose to ye nearest pond of deep stream of water, and there, in ye presence of said magistrate and of her accusers, be publicly ducked by said officer in ye waters of ye pond. And I guess what I'd note here is the presence of the church and the magistrate and the officers. He goes on to talk about a woman named Betsy, wife of John Tucker, who by ye violence of her tongue had made his house and ye neighborhood uncomfortable. So she's a shrew. She's this traditional stereotype of the woman with the mean tongue. And she's going to be punished for talking in a rude way. And they talk about Betsy going under and being held under for the space of a minute. So if you imagine that, being on the end of one of these ducking stools and being put into water and not knowing when you're going to come up.
It's a little bit like waterboarding today.
Yeah. Well, part of my argument is that a lot of these themes, punitively, have returned. And waterboarding is one.
So Betsy is lowered on a stool.
She's lowered
on a stool. She's tied on this stool and then...
Yeah, she's tied. And she's actually very much a fighter. So she's actually under for half a minute, but it's still a long time. She had a stout stomach and would not yield until she had allowed herself to be ducked five several times, he says. And then I'd like you to hear her confession. At length, she cried piteously, let me go, by God's help, I'll sin no more. Then they drew back ye machine, untied ye ropes, and let her walk home in her wetted clothes, a hopefully penitent woman. That word penitent would actually lead to the word penitentiary. But you see that in the process of being punished, Betsy actually turns her soul over to God. She says, I'll be better, and according to Hartley, is penitent, and she'll sin no more. So these punishments in the early United States, and really from long before that, were very much associated with God and also with the church and with the royal leader.
I assume there probably was a double standard, too, in terms of women and men being punished for similar offenses.
Well, I think with the tongue, the women, there were things like a scold's bridle that women wore that would actually hold your tongue down. If you tried to talk, it would injure your tongue. So there were punishments really, really aimed at keeping women from talking. But with men, you know, the punishments were no less physical and no less painful. I mean, when you talk about whippings or cat of nine tails, you're talking about severe pain. Now, one of the things that happened after the revolution was you had people who had your new religious philosophies coming in. So one of the things that happened to Benjamin Rush, for instance, was a kind of shift from a belief that was Presbyterian and had inherited some Calvinist beliefs to something that was closer to Unitarian Universalism as we know it now. He heard a preacher, and in that year when he was hearing this preacher, Winchester, talk, he had an incident which he relates to his wife. His letters are quite wonderful, but he was out in the street, and in Pennsylvania they had these crews working in the road who were prisoners. And he sees a prisoner with a dog, and he starts talking to this prisoner, and this prisoner says, you know, this dog has followed me all the way from England. And he notes that the prisoner loves the dog and is very gentle and affectionate with this dog. And he realizes that he has this epiphany where he says his heart is not lost. It can be led back to God by a string. So he suddenly thinks that this person's not wicked and something can be done. And that's in some ways where we're getting this idea of rehabilitation. There were other people coming up with that idea, but Rush articulates it very well in that letter.
You also talk about William Penn and how he got criticized for making the punishments less in Pennsylvania than they had been.
Yeah, and yeah, I mean, the British basically took that power back, but he had set a standard, and he was a Quaker. Some of the early movements towards changing punishment, and it led to a grand experiment that in many ways failed over and over and over and led to, you know, new experiments and changes. And I would argue, actually, by the time we hit about the 1970s through the 90s, really had improved prisons. Now, I'm not saying they were perfect or benign places, but I think there was a lot of, you know, the intentions were there to reform, rehabilitate, and there were some good programs coming in. But, you know, they made serious mistakes along the way. And the Quakers had this idea of solitary being useful and that, you know, again, religious idea, that in this penitentiary where the penitents go who have committed crimes, that they would read the Bible all alone. And just like a hermit or a monk or someone alone in their cell devoted to God, these people would reflect upon their crimes. And Rush actually talks about this kind of terror sneaking up on them, this terror and awe of God, and would commit themselves to God and reform. In practice, it's not quite what happened. And that invention they came up with these solitary-style prisons, went out. By the 20th century, extended solitary confinement was considered mistreatment. But that kind of changed in the 90s when we had the Supermax come back. It came back in different form, though.
We're going to talk about some other aspects of punishment, including punishment of children and vigilante punishment, as with lynching, when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
Rules of school. Boys and girls playing together. 4 lashes. Quarreling. 4 lashes. Fighting. 5 lashes. Fighting at school. 5 lashes. Quarreling at school. 3 lashes. Gambling or betting at school. 4 lashes. Playing at cards at school. 10 lashes. Climbing for every foot over 3 feet up a tree. 1 lash. Telling lies. 7 lashes. Telling tales out of school. 8 lashes. Nicknaming each other. 4 lashes. Giving each other ill names. 3 lashes. Fighting each other in time of books. 2 lashes. Swearing at school. 8 lashes.
Those are some of the rules for how children were going to be punished in 1848 in a school in North Carolina. I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Air. My guest is Anne Marie Cusick, and she was reading from her book, Cruel and Unusual, The Culture of Punishment in America. You know, Anne Marie, I found it really fascinating. Your chapter called Punishment Creep, about how the ideas of punishment can creep into other areas of our society, including school. Very interesting to think about. And this list of punishments is quite interesting, where if you play cards at school, you get 10 lashes, which is worse than fighting at school, and so on.
Well, playing cards, I'm guessing because that's gambling.
Right. So that's especially bad. But how do you see the relationship between our attitudes towards criminals, adult criminals, and then what was happening in the school system with punishment?
One of the big warnings of my book is that punishment doesn't stay where we think it's staying. We think of it as reserved for prisoners and criminals. My research as a reporter suggested that kids were getting treated with some of these devices in schools, and that the public at large often was, and including people who might be at risk when shocked, including like very elderly people. So as I started doing this book, I thought, well, you know, I wonder if this parallel has gone on from the beginning. And in fact, what's very interesting about schools is it punishments that are outmoded, say, in prisons, keep going in the schools. So, for instance, you have in what would have been very late for a whipping post in a public square, you have one built into a schoolhouse. And that is actually still on display. They still have this in Massachusetts, this whipping post. And it served a very interesting function, very similar to the public square one, right? A student who misbehaved was strung up and whipped in front of the schoolmates to warn people not to do that, I would say, and also to mark that person as the guilty one. And, you know, the more I started looking, the more I found there really are a lot of parallels. So, for instance, you have when solitary confinement came into favor in prisons, you have schools building things like little dungeons, which are little solitary rooms to put bad kids in. Sometimes they're next to the fireplace or the heat up, which actually parallels a torture device that's a heat box that would go into the sun for a prisoner. You know, it's definitely uncomfortable. But there were also little rooms under the floor in some cases. And there actually was a child-raising book. This isn't schools, but it's child care, where at the moment that prisons became popular, because they really were the American thing, we created the modern prison and really celebrated it. And as I've noted, it's ironic in a nation of freedom. But parents were encouraged to whip kids under Calvinism to get them to convert quickly, partly because they could die quickly. You know, and the ideal is to get them to turn their souls over to God before they could catch ill and potentially die as infants. So there's a great deal of attention given to that. And when prisons came in and this kind of new idea of the soul shifting through a penitentiary and giving itself over to God, you had mother's books giving examples of parents saying things like, prison, go to prison, and the child putting itself in a little makeshift prison in the house and coming out and being better. So you have a lot of that going on and many other different physical punishments that actually echo the prisoners.
And you talk about the religious angle of the spare the rod and spoil the child, and how that from early on has been kind of a consistent thing in people's mind.
It certainly was under Calvinism. I mean, the spare the rod issue, though, was deeply religious for them and very, I mean, I guess I see it as, from what I've read, as a serious concern over the state of the soul, like a real belief in a very much at a time of when you could wake up one day after putting a child down at night and that child would be dead, really a sense that that child could go to hell and a belief in it. And that came back, though, as a kind of advocacy in the 70s, when what I see as a shift from a belief in rehabilitation to one that's more retributive happened. So you have parents saying, look, these are published in a lot of books, and they tend to be members of the religious right, which right now is not advocating in the same all the same things that it did at that point. But you can find publications saying this. You see them saying, if you don't spank your child, you could create a juvenile delinquent. And that's actually echoed. There was a pastor who went to prison for beatings of children in front of the parish in the early part of this century, around 2000. And he also said that. That's my child becoming a juvenile delinquent if I don't whip him. So there's a warning that coming back, that you need to physically hurt children in order to make them turn their souls over to God and also not commit crime. And it's very interesting that that was linked to crime. So this arose in the 70s. And at the same time, you have people announcing things like rehabilitation's failed and the prisons have failed. One thing I find very interesting is that this didn't remain confined to religious groups, that it actually moved into the general population as a kind of philosophy, that children were dangerous, that they maybe were wicked from birth. And so you see an article in Newsweek in the mid-70s talking about the criminal mind. But when you read the article, it's actually the mind of a child. And similarly, Time magazine in 1977 writes about juvenile delinquency in the youth crime plague and saying things like, how can such sadistic acts, expressions of what moral philosophers would call sheer evil, be explained satisfactorily by poverty and deprivation? So basically rejecting the idea that your background creates you and arguing for evil in a very mainstream publication.
In other words, saying some children are just born to become criminals.
Yes, but also using a word like evil. I mean, evil is a word that we can use in a very general sense, but in many cases, it's also got a religious connotation. So I was interested in how that happened. And by the time I was reporting, there were young kids as young as 6 years old, being tased. Police were carrying tasers. The big company that made them was saying police are carrying these in schools. And you also saw evidence that they were carrying them in elementary schools. In some cases, you could maybe say, well, this was a good, it might have prevented the kid from cutting the officer with a piece of glass or something. There was one case with a six-year-old like that. But there was a child taste for stabbing another child with a pencil. There was a child taste for running away from a police officer. There was a child, and when I say tased, I mean hit with a taser. There was a child hit with a taser who was handcuffed in a police car. So those were happening at a time when these devices, these electronic devices, had been really marketed not for use on kids, but for use on hardened criminals who are dangerous. So that's really my warning, that we tend to treat children in the same way that we treat prisoners, and we treat members of the public that way, too.
Another aspect of your book that was interesting to me was the widespread punishment of minorities, whether it's the vigilante punishment with lynching or today when we have such a disproportionate number of particularly black men, but members of minorities that are behind bars.
Well, you know,
let's go back to the sort of vigilante style, you know, the Ku Klux Klan punishment, the lynchings and so on. It seems as if there was a whole area of punishment occurring in this country that operated outside of the legal system.
Well, yeah. One thing I want to give some context to this by quoting someone named Samuel Walker, who wrote a book called Popular Justice. And he points out that in America, justice is popular. It's got a democratic piece to it. That accounts for the good parts of punishment, he says, and also what's not so good, including vigilante killings. I think this is important because he also says that when police brutality happens and when abuse in prisons happens, that that's supported by public, that the public backs it. And I think he's right. So, you know, my own experience just being a reporter suggests that to me.
How so?
Well, two things come to mind. One is I've had a lot of people get very angry with me because I report on prisoners or become dismayed by the fact that I'm doing this, you know.
Because they assume you're sympathetic to the prisoners and not the victims,
yeah,
or
I think
soft
that's
on
the
crime. That
all of those
thing.
Things. Mm-hmm. But also, I think in some cases, you know, I've had people say to me, well, the stun belt's really useful. I know some people I'd like to put it in. You know, they make jokes about it. I've had a public school teacher say, I had a student I'd like to put in that stun belt. You know, this is a device that goes off for 8 seconds at 50,000 volts, and there's no stopping it. So that always made me think a lot. And then the other piece is Abu Ghraib, because when we hit Abu Ghraib in this country and those revelations came about of severe allegations of mistreatment, nudity in front of women, you had issues of, you know, people being threatened by dogs, etc., mock executions while blindfolded, extensive restraints so people had to soil themselves. I saw people get very angry about that. I was glad that they were angry about that. But my reaction was very different. I mean, I'd been reporting for 8 years at that point on prisons. I read a lot about, you know, other people's reporting on these, what was happening in American prisons. And when I saw the Abu Ghraib photos and read about this, I thought, oh, there it is. I've been expecting it to occur since we were establishing prisons elsewhere. It was familiar. It was a little sickening, but it was familiar.
You mean because you had seen similar things domestically?
Yeah. You know, Donald Rumsfeld said this was not American. But to me, it was very American. I had seen very similar things and actually wrote a piece shortly after that, which shows up in the book in altered form, that went through a number of very recent, you know, pretty recent occurrences in the United States that paralleled those. So that's why I say what I said earlier when I said this.
That it's popular.
It's popular, yeah. So vigilantism is an example of popular justice and the bad, dark side of it. You had crowds getting very angry at executions, including in Wisconsin. Wisconsin dropped capital punishment. But at the same time that that was going down, you had people taking the law into their own hands more and more. And this, of course, follows the Civil War. You have sort of an anger at freedom for African Americans. And you also have a situation where people who had previously been slaves and their children were, in fact, not as much under the control of people who thought, in some cases, that they deserved to control them. One of the things I go through in this book is also, you know, the treatment of slaves, because that parallels prison, too. It's very physical. So there's this rise, and it's you know, the big rise in vigilantism happens after a bit of a gap. So people don't really know a whole lot about slavery anymore. You know, that's not their world. And they start to kill. I thought it was very interesting that as capital punishment was going down, this was going up. And that it was...
When you say this, you mean things like the lynchings?
Lynchings, yeah.
Yeah. You also talk about how in our own times, with the disproportionate number of African Americans locked up, that it alters the voting pattern,
yeah.
That you have a large proportion of people who are disenfranchised.
Yeah, and this is not so much my argument as a man named Sasha Abramsky made it, and the organization Demos. And they're really talking about not only those who are locked up, but those who are disenfranchised for life after they get out, you know. And you know, many states don't do that, but some do. And they started to argue, or even if they're allowed to vote, don't think they have the right to vote. So it becomes a question for them. They actually argue that it might have, and Sasha Abramsky argues that this might have determined the election of 2000. At minimum, though, if we have 1 out of 100 people in prison, and then you start looking at how many, you know, 1/3 of adult black males in the prison system, you start to wonder what that would do to the vote if they actually got to vote. I think that's a big question. So, yeah, that's a democratic question.
Another aspect of your book has to do with popular culture and the way our fascination with cop shows and with movies about crime and punishment play a role in what we actually do. And we're going to talk about that when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
In the old days, in France, they had beheadings of people who committed heinous crimes. Although Las Vegas has a lovely highway system, these punks come along and deface it. I'm saying maybe you put them on TV and cut off a thumb. That may be the right thing to do.
That was a comment by Las Vegas Mayor Oscar Goodman when he appeared in late 2005 on a television show. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Air. My guest is Anne-Marie Cusick, and she was reading from her book Cruel and Unusual, The Culture of Punishment in America. We're going to talk about pop culture and television in a minute. Before we do that, you had mentioned when we were talking a few minutes ago about the parallels between Abu Ghraib and our own prison system, the fact that when you saw the photos and heard the news about what was happening there, which caused such widespread outrage about the methods, the torture, the punishment being used, that you weren't surprised. You were only surprised that we were reacting to that when we weren't reacting to what was happening already in America. What sort of direct parallels did you see?
Well, I saw, for instance, actually my first reaction was seeing that photograph of the man who was robed and hooded and strung with electrical wiring. I thought, oh, Sacramento, because of the incidents where people were put in restraint chairs there, and there was a big legal case on this, and masked, and then threatened with electric shock. So that immediately made me wonder what else is going on. Then I heard people were threatened with dogs. Well, there'd been a videotape end up on national TV from Brazoria County, Texas, which was a training video for guards. And it showed, it basically demonstrated how guards use dogs to intimidate inmates. So that was very much a parallel. The use of putting inmates in women's underwear. Well, in Phoenix, the sheriff is famous for putting inmates of the jail in pink underwear. I don't see a big difference because pink is often associated as a feminine color.
And is that done for humiliation purposes? Or
that's my guess. It's Sheriff Joe Arpaio who calls himself America's toughest sheriff, and certainly he's trying to show his toughness by putting inmates in that. So apparently they don't like it. I think at one point he said that he did not want them stealing the underwear, so he dyed it pink. But it has an effect, a kind of humiliating effect. You had incidents where people were restrained for long times and had to defecate and urinate where they were. One very interesting parallel to Abu Ghraib is a man named Lane McCotter, who worked for the Utah State Prison System. And when I was reporting on the restraint chair, there was a man named Michael Valent who spent his last 14 hours nude in it and died after he got up, after being in a restraint chair. And Lane McCotter also advocated use of the restraint board, which is basically ties someone either on their front or their back on a board. And there was one case where an inmate was chained to it for 12 weeks, was allowed to get up four times a week to shower, and had to defecate and urinate on the board. So very similar. There are other examples of extensive restraint in the United States. Amnesty International has criticized the United States for using restraint. So that was very similar. The Red Cross report said that people in Iraq were being kept in degrees of about 120 and that you know, basically was too hot. But again, in Phoenix, the AP reported that inside the tent jail, there's a tent jail system run by Sheriff Joe Arpaio, that during a heat wave, the temperature inside reached 138 degrees.
Wow.
Even accusations such as there were sexual humiliation with devices and writing epithets on people's bodies and things like that, there are parallels here of that. So, and they're all recent ones. I'm not talking things that go back to colonial times. I'm talking last decade or so.
You must have run across some things that just turned your stomach. I mean,
yeah.
You know, whether you go back to colonial times when people were having their ears cut off or being tarred and feathered or drawn and quartered or whatever, or put in stocks, or recent times, you must have sometimes run across accounts and just, just been disgusted.
It's very difficult material to write about. And I'll tell you, it's actually pop culture that got to me the most, because when I was writing those chapters, I was watching all this, you know, all the police dramas, all the movies, and including the horror movies of that I wasn't allowed to watch as a kid, you know, and oddly, that really got into my brain. This, I think, as a reporter, because I did it professionally, I divided it off. I kept a very calm life. But yes, some of the restraint chair stories, et cetera, were pretty hard to write about.
And what is the relationship, do you think, between the way we punish people and our interest in popular culture in so many cop shows and so many, you know, we if you look at the listings on TV, so many of them have to do with solving crime, punishing criminals.
And they're consistently popular. When I was writing this book, it was over and over. I'd check and I'd see, well, what made the top 10? And it was, you know, 5 or 6 of the top 10 were always cop shows. And I just checked this week, it's 4 of them. So it's gone down one maybe. But number 3 was NCIS. Number 5 was NCIS Los Angeles. Number 8 was Criminal Minds. And 9 was CSI New York, which is hanging in there. Law and Order seems to have kind of gone down. But for a long time, that was in the top 10. I guess one of the things I'd say is, you know, when we talk about popular justice, if in America, justice is popular, and you have people like Oscar Goodman appearing on TV to advocate very painful physical punishments and winning votes that way, then we have to think about this mass audience that really was reachable by television. And it's possible, some people have argued, that in a country as diverse as ours, in a country that's often in conflict over all sorts of economic questions, I mean, just look at us right now, punishment and crime, and now terror, you know, punishment of terrorism, stopping terrorism, those are the only things we really can agree on. And so it's possible that the huge appearance, you know, the long-term shows like Cops, that you know, in these shows that run, not only are the most popular ones, but run in incessant reruns, you know, it's hard to avoid cop shows, that they are there as a kind of method to draw us together and help us sort of practice our culture.
Or is it that we like to see crime solved, kind of wrapped up, because so often in real life, it doesn't work out that way?
Well, one thing I really noted, because I used to love as a kid Starsky and Hutch and was not allowed to watch Charlie's Angels, but really wanted to. And those films in the 70s, when punishment was very different from now, those shows showed characters really trying to solve crime, stop the crime in its midst. And the thing I noted as I wrote this book was that had really changed. It was one of the few things I really could tell had changed a lot, apart from the fact that we were living in what, you know, broadcast executives were calling the golden age of crime drama, like the first time it had really dominated more than any other time. But the shows were different, and the shows were different in that they usually started out with a brutal crime. I remember one where a girl comes home and sees her parents on the couch with their heads cut off, you know. It starts with a crime. You can't stop the crime. The whole aim of shows like CSI and Law and Order, in many cases, was simply to find the perpetrator. And you never see the person going to prison, just like we never see prisoners going to prison. We don't know what happens to them in there when we're on the outside. But that is the implication of the show. It's all about punishment. It just doesn't say it directly.
Have you looked much into the difference in the way we punish our criminals and the way it's done abroad? You know, if in fact we punish so many more of our citizens than European countries do, for instance.
Well, Europe is, I mean, yeah, very different from Europe. I guess the only country where we're really closer in numbers is China now. But I actually had a lot of experience going over to Europe. For a while there, you know, I'd go over and I went to Amnesty International a couple times. And one time I was talking about what was going on in the United States. And there were all these representatives from other countries, police forces and prison forces, and very envious of the tools the Americans had. But at the same time, and I think it's really accelerated since then, there was a rising criticism of the death penalty. And the moment the United States started exporting its punishment practices or et cetera to Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib, the criticism really mounted. So there's now a skepticism, but for a long time, you know, we popularized the prison. That model of the penitentiary went from the United States, came from Europe originally, maybe, but we modernized it, sent it back, and it was very big there. For a long time, the United States was really a leader in this, but there's a growing skepticism about how we punish now.
You also talk about the Pope and the criticism of death penalty.
The Pope. Yeah. Well, the Pope came, you know, the Catholic Church came out against capital punishment. And it's one of the religious movements that is promising in terms of maybe we should be punishing in a different way. So, yeah, the Pope came over and made that announcement. But Sister Helen Prejean actually claims to have influenced him, and she's a famous anti-capital punishment spokesperson.
So after doing all this research on the various ways over the last few centuries that Americans have punished at school, punished sort of outside the law, punished with supermax prisons, all the rest of it, what would you say the sort of take-home message is of your book? What would you like people to take away from it?
I would like people to be warned, because our prisoners in many ways are us. They are going to come back into our communities, and the tools that we use on them don't stay in prisons. They influence our culture in many ways. I mean, tasers are used for crowd control right now. And this heat ray that's been introduced to the LA jails, I know the sheriff there wants to use that for crowd control. Well, that's a military device originally. And it, at a higher power, apparently was blamed for causing burns of military people that were pretty serious. So I think those devices become public devices. And even if they aren't becoming that, our culture's influenced in numerous other ways. The ways we raise our children, the ways we imagine goodness and badness, the ways that we elect people, that is the big one, because you see politician upon politician across parties using these tough-on-crime stances to gain votes. And it was a big deal for Bill Clinton. It was a big deal for George W. Bush. And Obama's not exempt from it. And as we punish, we expand this prison system, we expand the cost, we expand the number. And many of these people, only 19% of prisoners are violent criminals. 5% of them are murderers. The rest are drug criminals, and then there's basically a category of other that includes things like fraud. But 63% of our criminals are nonviolent.
We also have a lot of mentally ill people.
A lot of mentally ill
people are being punished rather than treated, correct?
Well, yeah. And, you know, I mean, and actually with the jail system, you really see it, because you see people going in and out of jail. And the jailer's being used to it, but they're not doctors. The New York Times has done great reporting on that, actually.
What about the link between poverty and being punished?
Well, that's a very odd one, because, I mean, they're, you know that during this recession, crime has continued to go down. So even though there's real social upheaval and poverty happening, that's a major question now. But I think the bigger warning is we've had more than a decade where crime is dropping, and we are punishing more and more people with very long sentences. 1 out of 5 in California is a life sentence. So is that adding up? And is it really helping our culture? Or, you know, I would suggest it's harming it.
A lot of thought there, a lot of things to think about as we look at who is in prison and what's happening to them there and how it relates to our history over the centuries of punishing people. My guest has been Anne-Marie Cusick, and her book is Cruel and Unusual, The Culture of Punishment in America. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
I'm Emily Auerbach, hoping you'll join Norman Gilliland and me for the next hour of University of the Air. Thank you.
Next Sunday afternoon at 4 during University of the Air, we'll go back to the Middle Ages and find out about how people's attitudes towards animals changed and how that affected the way humans acted with each other. Join us next Sunday afternoon at 4 here on Wisconsin Public Radio.